Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1.
Medications require eligibility and prescription. Patients on 15 milligrams of tirzepatide had an average of 21% weight loss in a 72-week clinical trial when paired with diet and exercise. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
Rogers believed that you could use the information that's being provided to you from your body, sort of bottom up, to determine when you were being inauthentic or non-congruent. And I've thought about this for a long time and tried to sort it out in a practical manner, and what I've concluded is this. You can try this for a couple of weeks. It's an extremely interesting exercise. So you sort of have to detach yourself from your thoughts and your what you say. So you got to assume, you start by assuming that what you say and what you think is not necessarily you. And of course, that's just the case, because a lot of what you think, in fact, most of what you think and most of what you say are the opinions of other people. They're things you've read or things people have told you, and you know, that's a benefit in some ways because you get all those thoughts that other people have spent a long time formulating, but it's a disadvantage in that it's not exactly you. Okay, so you detach yourself from that. You're no longer your thoughts or the things that you say, or maybe you're no longer all of them. And now what you're going to try to find out is which of your thoughts and things that you say are you? And maybe so you cannot utilize the rest, or maybe so that you can correct the rest, because they're not representative of yourself as an integrated being. They don't take everything into account. My sense has been that you can tell when you're saying something that's not authentic by feeling out whether or not it makes you weak or strong. Now, you know, sometimes when you're conversing with people, you can say something that embarrasses yourself. Now, Nietzsche said, for example, everyone has perjured themselves at least once in the attempt to maintain their good name. Something like that. It's not an exact quote, but I've got the gist of it right. So maybe you're saying things to impress someone, or you're saying things to remain part of your political group or your social group or whatever. Or maybe you have attributes, personal attributes, that might be positive that you're ashamed of, and so you're not going to speak about them. So there's a falseness about your self-representation. Watch for 2 weeks and see. Make a rule that if you start to say something and it makes you feel weak, it's hard to describe exactly what that means. To me, what it means is that I can feel things coming apart sort of in my midsection, so I think it's an autonomic phenomena. And the subjective sense is of falsehood. It's like I've just stepped off the solid ground and onto something that doesn't support me well, and it feels like a self-betrayal. So that's existential inauthenticity. You can feel it right away. And then the rule is, shut up if that happens. Stop talking. And then feel around and see if you can find some words that you can say in that situation that don't produce that sensation. And it's like, you see this played out in different forms of drama. So it's not all that obvious why a cliché is a bad thing, but a cliché is a bad thing in the same way that being possessed by the dead is a bad thing. It's like a cliché isn't you. It's something else. It's like the crowd. It's like the other. It's not living. It has nothing to do with you. And part of the reason that students use clichés is because it's easier than using your own genuine creative formulation. So you can just default to cliché use, but there's something more insidious than that, is that if you write an essay that's nothing but a string of clichés and you get criticized, then you're not being criticized. What's being criticized is the clichés, and you can hide behind that, and the part of you that's wise but treacherous thinks, well, the criticism doesn't really apply to me because, you know, I didn't really say what I thought. And then there's this kind of sense you get that you've gotten away with something, which is a terrible thing. So when I read undergraduate essays, what I see very frequently is, especially the first essays, just nothing but cliches. It's awful. It's dull. You can hardly stand reading it because there's nothing in it that's gripping or alive. And then maybe the second essay, you can see there's a layer of cliché, and then now and then the person will be brave enough to poke up a thought of their own. It'll just sort of poke up somewhere maybe in 3 pages in. It's like this little green shoot that's barely alive, and the person is brave enough to pop it up in the hope that, you know, maybe it won't get walloped down with a sledgehammer. And so one of the things I try to do is to point that out. It's like, look, you know, this is something. There's a real thought here. It's a real original thought. It's something that you have the right to because it's derived from your own experience and your own knowledge. And you formulated it in an original and compelling way. But the problem with that is that if you get criticized for that, you're just going to pull right back into your shell, right? Because that hurts, because it's actually part of you that you've exposed. And that's a terrifying thing, to expose yourself like that. But it's an absolute prerequisite to genuine communication and thought. So, the ancient Mesopotamians, I haven't got time to tell you this story. If you want to hear it, you can come to my Maps of Meaning class in your fourth year. But the ancient Mesopotamians had figured out 5,000 years ago or so that the highest god in the hierarchy of gods, so sort of like the highest value, or the thing that should be imitated most carefully, was a god that whose head had eyes all the way around it, and who spoke magic words. And so the words he spoke could make the sun rise and make the sun set. Very, very powerful speaker. And the reason the Mesopotamians had figured this out to the degree they had was because they realized that the capacity to pay attention, which is the eyes, of course, because we really pay attention with our eyes, and then the capacity to speak properly is, in fact, the highest virtue. And so then you can check yourself, you can see, all you have to do is listen, like you would listen to someone else. And you have to feel, you think, do I actually believe that? Is that actually my thought? And really, I'll tell you, what you'll find is 95% of what you say has nothing to do with you. So it's quite shocking to do this, because you'll start to say something, and you'll think, oh, that doesn't feel quite right. Like, it doesn't make me feel solid when I say it. There's something about that I'm subordinating myself to something or hiding in some way. It's very difficult to figure out exactly what you're doing. But you'll find out that almost everything that's abstractly represented, it has to be that way because you guys are all so young. So in some sense, you know way more than you can actually know, right? You've been taught all these things, but you don't know them. They're just in your head. In fact, they have you rather than the other way around. It's like Carl Jung said, people don't have ideas. Ideas have people. And that's something to really think about, because then you want to watch and see what ideas there are floating around in your head and start to figure out where they came from, because it's highly probable that they're controlling you, just like a marionette is controlled by the puppeteer. It's very, very similar. Now, when Jung talked about archetypes, it was never clear what he meant, and I think the reason for that was because the archetype is a very complicated idea and a very complicated phenomena, and you can think about it biologically, and you can think about it socially, and you can think about it as something that the individual participates in creating. So it's not that easy to localize it. And as well, it's not that easy to localize it. And as well, Jung was never clear about what the universe of archetypes looked like. At some times he spoke as if they were a relatively small number, and then at other times he spoke as if they were innumerable. And I think the reason for that is, in part, it depends on the level of analysis, right? The more transcendent the archetype, the fewer they are, but they differentiate, because you might say, well, how many hero archetypes are there? And one answer could be one. But they differentiate all the way out into the diverse range of works of fiction that we have. So you could say there's as many variants of the hero archetype, roughly speaking, as there are works of fiction. So you think about it as a hierarchy with the ultimate archetype at the top. So then another question might be, what does the landscape of ultimate archetypes look like? And I think that's what I tried to lay out, and that's what I'm trying to lay out in this diagram. So now, why do you want to know that?
there's a practical reason, or the way, there's a number of practical reasons as well as intellectual reasons. One of the most relevant practical reasons, as far as I'm concerned, is that integrating narratives, and so those would include political narratives, integrating narratives have their force because they draw on universal archetypes. Otherwise they wouldn't have any power, right? Because they're basically stories. Political stories derive their power from the underlying archetypal representations. Obviously, because they have to be concerned with the things that people find important, right? How can you sell a political message to someone if it isn't about something they find important? And if it's important to them, it's going to be grounded at least to some degree in their biological in their biological substructure. I mean, if you're talking to hungry people about food, it's a story that you can tell, right? Because it hooks them deeply. It hooks deep into their motivational systems. To use a narrative of utopia, which is the land of milk and honey, roughly speaking, a very, very old idea, you're also tapping deeply into intrinsic human longings. And so the idea that political narratives incorporate archetypal themes is not an idea that I would consider particularly controversial. Putting it that way might be. Okay, so the problem with political narratives, in my estimation, is that they can rapidly transform themselves into ideologies. And ideologies are dangerous for a variety of reasons, but the primary reason for their danger, I think, this is a hypothesis, is because of their one-sided nature. What happens is that they capitalize, parasitize, I think is even a better way of thinking about it, a profound underlying narrative, but they don't tell the entire story. And so then if you're looking for orientation in the world because you're fragmented and chaotic, and somebody provides you with a partial story, that's going to serve an integrating function. And it's one of the things you see in psychotherapy is that if you're chaotic and confused and you go see a therapist who has a particular kind of practice, Freudian, behavioral, cognitive, Rogerian, whatever, there's a high probability that undergoing that course of therapy is going to be good for you, and that you might even come to view your life in the terms of that therapeutic practice. And you might say, well, why is that therapeutic practice right for you? Maybe it could have been Rogerian instead of Freudian, say. And the answer to that is, yeah, well, it probably could have been, because roughly speaking, any coherent ordering principle is better than none. And so that's also a good way to think about human development from an intellectual perspective, is that partly what has to be provided to individuals as they mature into adults is some kind of ordering structure. You don't have a videotape memory, and it isn't obvious that the memories that you have of traumatic events are fully fledged and causally appropriate, but just not paid attention to. It's more like they're murky and unclear in and of themselves, and they contain too much. And I don't think that people so much repress as they do refuse to attend to, or are unable to attend to. So it's more like a passive avoidance than a passive avoidance of something that needs to be explored and gone through, rather than it is something you know that you don't want to look at, that you or part of you has put away. Terrible things have happened to you, and you or some part of you doesn't want to know about them, And so they live those repressed experiences live an autonomous life of their own too. And here's an example of a trivial example of how that might work. Imagine that you're at work and your boss says something to you that disturbs you. Maybe it makes you question whether your job is stable. And so you're kind of upset about that, but it's a casual offhand comment. And you go back to work and you just sort of forget that even happened. You know, maybe because you're attending to something else. But then you go home and you're just crabby as can possibly be. And you go home and one of the people there says something a little annoying and you snap at them. It's like, well, that's analogous to what Freud would call a complex, right? Is that this, because you can imagine what's happened is that the boss's words have...
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
All medications require eligibility and prescription. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
Some days you want a little extra oomph to your usual look. Whether that's lashes for days with the Viral Liquid Lash Extensions Mascara or awakening your eyes with a lasting lift and soft color with the Brilliant Eye Brightener, Thrive Cosmetics is your go-to when you want to amplify your everyday look. Whether you want a simple, just got to get out of the door routine or full glam, you'll always look and feel like the best version of yourself with Thrive Cosmetics. Plus, every product is 100% vegan, cruelty-free, and made with clean, skin-loving ingredients that work with your skin, not against it. And for every product purchased, Thrive Cosmetics donates to help communities thrive. So every time you use your favorite Thrive Cosmetics product, you're helping communities you care about too. Amplify your everyday. Go to thrivecosmetics.com/shine26 for an exclusive offer of 20% off your first order. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS.com/shine26.
I've brought up a whole little sub-personality predicated on doubt up to the surface. And who knows how deep that would be? Well, what happens if I lose my job? And if I lose my job, well, what sort of person am I exactly? And what about all these other times that I've failed? And then maybe you remember the other times that you failed. And what am I going to do in the future? And so it's this whole cluster of ideas that surrounds that doubt. And that's been activated. It's a little part of you. And then maybe you're not attending to that because you're busy doing some other work. But when you go home, something triggers it. And it, like, it's already there. It's already, you get way more upset than you should. And that's what a complex is, except in a much more complicated manner. Like, a complex might be a whole series of experiences that you've had that are united by some emotion, like threat, that haven't been transformed into a coherent representation, but that can rise out of the unconscious and possess you. If you guys, many of you guys have been depressed at least one point in your life, you know, it's actually very common for University of Toronto students, especially in their first year. It's about 1 in 3. If you give students the Beck Depression Inventory, about 1 in 3 University of Toronto students in our research have hit criteria for hospitalization. I mean, the Beck is a little oversensitive as far as I'm concerned, but you know what it's like when you're depressed? It's like, it's a part of your personality sort of subsumes the whole, and depression quite classically is, well, you can't think of anything good that happened to you in the past, and you can't think of any reason why the present is good for anything, and you're pretty damn hopeless about the future. And so that's a complex as well, and it's a complex that consists of nothing but negative emotion, and it structures your memory and your perception and your plans for the future all at the same time. Now, Freud had a very lengthy list of ways that people could be treacherous towards experiences they had that they wanted to repress. And so he called them defense mechanisms. This is how you fool yourself into believing that you don't have to take into account a certain set of negative experiences. You know, it's like, well, we'll go through them. Repression. Okay, well, we talked about that. Denial. Well, that often, denial is a very complicated one. See if I can come up with a good example. Well, there's a classic example for people who have, I think it's called anosognosia, I don't remember exactly. It's neglect. That's a less technical way of thinking about it. So let's say you have a right parietal damage from a stroke, and you lose the left side of your body, so you can't move it anymore. But worse, you don't know it's there, and you don't know that the left side of anything is there anymore. And God only knows how that happens. But like, you'll only eat half the food on your plate, only on the right-hand side. And if someone asks you to draw a clock, you'll cram all the numbers into the one side. And so you kind of lose the idea of left. And I think it's sort of like, you know how when you're looking forward, there's nothing behind you? You can't see anything back here. It's not black. It's not even gone. It's just simply not there at all. And so if you could imagine that sort of stretching around halfway, that seems to be something what neglect is like. But anyways, if you take someone with neglect, according to Ramachandran, and if you irrigate their ear with cold water, the ear on the opposite side, then they'll kind of have a little convulsion, and then all of a sudden they become aware of their missing left side. If you talk to them before you do the irrigation, you say, well, what's up with your left arm? And they'll say, well, my arthritis is bothering me and I don't want to move it. They come up with some something that sounds akin to denial, you know. And then if you can snap them out of that with that irrigation, then they'll have a catastrophic emotional response, logically enough, to the loss of their entire left side. And Ramachandran reports that lasting about 20 minutes, and then they'll snap out of it and go right back into the denial. And sometimes people deny things because they can't update. What's happened to them is so overwhelming that they cannot construct a new model. They just rely on the old one. And you see this, well, imagine first that you've just had a tooth pulled and you know how long your tongue takes to like remap the inside of your mouth. It's really hard to come up with a new concept of you if something catastrophic happens. And so sometimes the denial is just that something, the thing that has happened is so overwhelming that the person can't model it. But then maybe also they refuse to think about it. And you see this emerging in lots of strange ways. So for example, if people develop diabetes, for example, they're often not very good at taking their medication or regulating their diet. And you might say, well, they're denying the existence of their illness. And to some degree, they're probably doing that because who the hell wants to think that they're diabetic? But even worse than that, it's like, it's complicated to be diabetic. You're no longer the same person that you were. And so you have to learn a whole bunch of new ways to be this new person. What to eat, when to eat, how to check your blood. You have to be careful whenever you go out and eat. Like, there's 100 new things a day that you have to learn. And so separating denial from inability is a hard one, but you can also understand that people might deny, no, that's just not happening. That's I'm not going to admit to that. Reaction formation. Oh, that's one. Maybe you hate your sister, and maybe you have your reasons, but you shouldn't hate your sister. So what you do is act as if you really, really like her. That's an overcompensation. So that's another form of defense mechanism. Displacement. My boss yells at me, I yell at my husband yells at the baby bites the cat. Well, they're not really dealing with the problem, which is the boss. It's just pushed on down the road. And identification, you're bullied. And instead of coming to terms with the fact that bullying occurs, you start bullying other people. Rationalization, well, you know what that means already. You know, maybe you don't do your homework, you're procrastinating. I bet you can come up with 15 rationalizations, no problem, for why it's actually not necessary for you to do your homework right then. Intellectualization, well, Woody Allen's movies are about like that. He's got all these neurotic problems, but he's smart, and so he can come up with intelligent reasons why he's so messed up, even though he knows he's messed up and it doesn't help. If you track women through their ovulation cycle and you show them a picture of a man, same man, and you do nothing but vary his jaw width, when they're ovulating, the guy with the wider jaw is more attractive, and when they're not ovulating, the farthest away from that, the guy with the thinner jaw is more attractive, and that's associated with testosterone levels. And so women who are fertile like more masculine men, and basically if you're on the pill, then you're never in that ovulation phase. And so one thing that may have happened, and I don't know this for sure, but it's interesting to consider, is that since women have been taking the birth control pill, their preference for less masculine men has become more pronounced. And that could easily be one of the things that's fueling at least some of the tension that's existed and exists now politically between men and women. But the point is that you just cannot ignore the massive consequences of a biological revolution like that, and to make any other factor causal when you're trying to understand the political movements, especially in the last, say, 40 years, you're putting the cart before the horse. Now, it's reasonable to point out that the pill wouldn't have been accepted as a technology if certain political changes with regards to the emancipation of women hadn't already been in place, right? No one would have even been allowed to do something like investigate contraception. So you can't separate the biological from the political entirely, but it's still very useful to organizing your thinking to realize just how profound a revolution that was. But the neurological structure isn't exactly the mind. Like, the neurological structure isn't exactly your consciousness. There's some relationship between them that we don't know. And the unconscious, from a conceptual perspective, is the place that your memories are that you sometimes can get access to and sometimes can't. And so you might think, well, that there are the memories that you can't get access to. There might be a variety of reasons you can't get access to them. One might be that you've just forgotten them. And one might be that they're so painful that you don't want to bring them to mind. You'll engage in tricks to stop yourself from getting access to them. Or maybe they're memories that are so complex that and painful that even if you did get access to them, you wouldn't exactly know what to do with them. And so there's not a lot of reason for you to bring them to mind, because all it is pain without any utility. And when you understand that a little bit, you understand more about what Freud meant by repression. The thing about Freud is that he kind of believed that, like many people believe now, that when you remember an event in the past, it's almost as if you're using a videotape recorder, and that when you experience that, the memory is somehow recorded in you like it happened. But that's not a very accurate version of how memory works. I mean, we know that memories can be easily distorted. For example, if you interview someone about an event and you make suggestions that there was something present in the event that wasn't there, and then you bring them back a couple of weeks later and you ask them about the same event, they'll often incorporate the thing that they were told into the event. And the idea that you can make an objective record of something that's happening to you is kind of a strange notion anyways, because, so for example, if you're having an argument with someone and later you're asked what the argument was about and the other person is asked what the argument is about, there's no necessary reason why the accounts will jibe at all, because a lot of time when you're having an argument with someone, you're arguing about what the argument is about, right? You say, well, you're angry at me. Well, why? This is why I think you're angry at me. And you say, no, this is why I think this event has occurred. And you're thinking about, especially if we know each other well, you're thinking about the contextualization of that event across our entire history. And I'm doing the same thing. And I'm going to highlight things that you're not going to highlight. And I'm going to draw causal inferences that you're not going to draw. And for us just to get on the same page about the memory is going to be very difficult. So the idea that, especially with complex interactions with people, that you can somehow make a video recording of the memory and actually capture what happens is very, very... It's not true. You can't. I mean, you might be able to extract out certain objective facts, but generally, if it's a dialogical issue, if it's a relationship issue, it spans such a long period of time that just cutting a slice of it out doesn't constitute a reasonable record of what it means. And that's what you're more concerned with, too. Like, when you have an experience, you're not so much concerned about what happened from an objective perspective. You're more concerned about what the experience means. And then you might ask, well, what does it mean something? And that was the question I was trying to answer in that paper I had you read right at the beginning of the class. But one of the things that meaning means is that it has implication for the way you look at the world or the way you act in the world. And so if I tell you something meaningful, what that's going to mean is in the future you're going to act slightly differently, or maybe radically differently, depending on how meaningful it is, but also that the way that you look at the world has shifted. And the way that you look at the world is actually an unconscious process. I mean, you don't know while you're looking at the world how it is or why it is that you're looking at the world in that way. I mean, because, well, first of all, it would just be too complicated. And second, you wouldn't be able to concentrate on what was actually going on. So your attention, for example, is mediated by unconscious forces. And you know that. You know that perfectly well. And this is another Freudian observation. You know, if you're sitting down to study, for example, your conscious intent is to study. But you know perfectly well that all sorts of distraction fantasies are going to enter the theater of your imagination nonstop and annoyingly. And there isn't really a lot you can do about that except maybe wait it out. You know, so you'll be sitting there reading and your attention will flicker away. You'll think about, I don't know, maybe you want to watch Jane the Virgin on Netflix or something like that, or maybe it's time to have a peanut butter sandwich, or you should get the dust bunnies from underneath the bed, or it's time to go outside and have a cigarette, or maybe it's time for a cup of coffee, or it's like all these subsystems in you that would like something aren't very happy just to sit there while you read this thing that you're actually bored by, and so they pop up and try to take control of your perceptions and your actions nonstop. Maybe you think, well, this is a stupid course anyways. Why do I have to read this damn paper, and what am I doing in university, and what's the point of life? It's like you can really get going if you're trying to avoid doing your homework. And then you might think, well, what is it in you that's trying to avoid? Because after all, you took the damn course and you told yourself to sit down. Why don't you listen?